The Third Eye by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 13, First Visit Home. We had arrived back in time for the Lagsar, or New Year, ceremonies. Everything had to be cleaned, everywhere tidied. On the 15th day, the Dalai Lama went to the cathedral for a number of services. With them ended, he came out for his tour of the Barkor, the ring road which went outside the Jokang and Council Hall, round by the marketplace, and completed the circuit between the big business houses. At this time of the celebrations, the solemnity was being replaced by jollity. The gods were pleased, and now was the time for pleasure and enjoyment. Huge frameworks from 30 to 40 feet high supported images made of colored butter. Some of the frames had butter pictures in relief of various scenes from our sacred books. The Dalai Lama walked around and examined each one. The most attractive exhibit earned for the Lamasery, making it the title of the best butter modelers of the year. We of Chakpori were not at all interested in these carnivals. It all seemed rather childish and unamusing to us. Nor were we interested in the other proceedings, when riderless horses raced across the plains of Lhasa in open competition. We were more interested in the giant figures representing characters from our legends. These figures were constructed on a light wooden framework to represent the body, and a very realistic huge head was fitted. Inside the head were butter lamps which shone through the eyes, and, in flickering, appeared to make the eyes move from side to side. A strong monk on stilts would be inside the frame of the figure, with his eyes giving a very indifferent view through the giant's midsection. All kinds of unusual accidents would happen to these performers. The poor wretch would put one stilt in a pothole and find that he was balancing on one stilt, or one stilt would perhaps skid on some slippery substance on the road. One of the worst things was when the lamps were jerked loose and set fire to the whole figure. Once, in later years, I was persuaded to carry round the figure of Buddha, the god of medicine. It was 25 feet high. The flowing robes flapped around my stilted legs. Moths flapped around as well, for the garments had been stored. As they jerked along the road, dust was shaken from the folds, and I sneezed and sneezed and sneezed. Every time I did so, I felt that I was going to topple over. Every sneeze caused a further jerk and added to my discomfort by spilling hot butter from the lamps over my shaven and suffering head. The heat was terrible. Swaths of moldy old clothes, swarms of bewildered moths, and hot butter. Normally, butter in a lamp is solid, with the exception of a little pool around the wick. Now, in this stifling heat, the whole lot had melted. The little peephole in the midsection of the figure was not in line with my eyes, and I could not let go of the stilts in order to rearrange it. All I could see was the back of the figure in front of me, and by the way it was hopping about and swaying, the poor wretch inside was having as bad a time as I. However, with the Dalai Lama watching, there was nothing to do but march on, suffocated with cloth, half roasted in butter fat. With the heat and exertion, I am sure I lost pounds of weight that day. A high lama that night said, "Oh, Lobsang, your performance was good. You would be an excellent comedian." I certainly did not tell him that the antics which amused him so much were entirely involuntary. Most definitely I did not carry a figure again. Not long after this, I think it may have been 5 or 6 months, there was a sudden terrific gale of wind with flying clouds of dust and grit. I was on the roof of a storehouse being instructed in how to lay sheet gold to make the roof waterproof. The gale caught me and whirled me off the flat roof to bump first on another roof some 20 feet lower. Another gust caught me and blew me over the edge and over the side of the Iron Mountain and down to the side of the Lingkor Road some 350 feet below. The ground was swampy and I landed with my face in the water. Something snapped, another branch, I thought. Dazedly, I tried to lift myself out of the mud, but found that the pain was intense when I tried to move my left arm or shoulder. Somehow, I got to my knees, to my feet, and struggled along to the dry road. I felt sick with pain, and I could not think clearly. My sole thought was to get up the mountain as quickly as possible. Blindly I struggled and stumbled along until about halfway up I met a party of monks rushing down to see what had happened to me and to another boy. He had landed on rocks and so was dead. I was carried up the rest of the way to the room of my guide. Quickly he examined me. Oh, poor boys, they should not have been sent out in such a gale. He looked at me. Well, Lobsang, you have a broken arm and a broken collarbone. We shall have to set them for you. It will hurt, but not more than I can help. While he was talking, and almost before I knew it, he had set the collarbone and bound splinting in place to hold the broken bones. The upper arm was more painful, but soon that too was set and splinted. For the rest of that day I did nothing but lie down. With the arrival of the next day, the Lama Mingyur Dandup said, "We cannot let you fall behind in studies, Lobsang. So you and I will study together here. Like all of us, you have a certain little dislike of learning new things, so I am going to remove that study antagonism hypnotically." He closed the shutters, and the room was in darkness, except for the faint light from the altar lamps. From somewhere, he took a small box, which he stood on a shelf in front of me. I seemed to see bright lights, colored lights, hands and bars of color, and then all appeared to end in a silent explosion of brightness. It must have been many hours later when I awoke. The window again was open, but the purple shadows of night were beginning to fill the valley down below. From the patala, little lights were twinkling in and around the buildings as the evening guard went around their duties, making sure that all was secure. I could look across the city where, too, the nightlife was now commencing. Just then, my guide came in. "Oh," he said, "so you have returned to us at last. We thought that you found the astral field so pleasant that you were staying a while. Now I suppose, as usual, you are hungry." As he mentioned that, I realized that I was, definitely. Food was soon brought, and as I ate, he talked. "By ordinary laws, you should have left the body, but your stars said you would live to die in the land of the Red Indians, or America, in many years' time. They are having a service for the one who did not stay. He was killed on the instant." It appeared to me that the ones who had passed over were the lucky ones. My own experiences in astral traveling had taught me that it was very pleasant, but then I reminded myself that we did not really like school, but we had to stay to learn things, and what was life on earth but a school? A hard one, too, I thought. Here am I with two broken bones, and I have to go on learning. For 2 weeks, I had even more intensive teaching than usual. I was told it was to keep my mind from thinking of my broken bones. Now, at the end of the fortnight, they had united, but I was stiff, and both my shoulder and my arm were painful. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, was reading a letter when I went into his room one morning. He looked up at me as I entered. "Lobsang," he said, "we have a packet of herbs to go to your honorable mother. You can take it tomorrow morning and stay the day." "I am sure my father would not want to see me," I answered. "He ignored me completely when he passed me on the steps of the Patala." "Yes, of course he did. He knew that you had just come from the Precious One. He knew that you had been specially favored, so he could not speak unless I was with you, because you are now my ward by order of the Precious One himself." He looked at me, and the corners of his eyes crinkled as he laughed. "Anyhow, your father will not be there tomorrow. He has gone to Yangtze for several days." In the morning, my guide looked me over and said, "You look a little pale, but you are clean and tidy, and that should count a lot with a mother. Here is a scarf. Don't forget that you are now a Lama and must conform to all the rules. You came here on foot. Today you will ride on one of our best white horses. Take mine. It needs some exercise." The leather bag of herbs, handed to me as I left, had been wrapped in a silk scarf as a sign of respect. I looked at it dubiously, wondering how I was going to keep the wretched thing clean. In the end, I took off the scarf and tucked it into my robe pouch until I was nearer home. Down the steep hill we went, the white horse and I. Halfway down, the horse stopped, turned his head around to get a good look at me. Apparently, he did not think much of what he saw, because he gave a loud neigh and hurried on as if he could not bear the sight of me any longer. I sympathized with them, as I had identical opinions about him. In Tibet, the most orthodox lamas ride mules, as they are supposed to be sexless affairs. Lamas who are not so finicky ride a mail horse or pony. For myself, I preferred to walk, if at all possible. At the bottom of the hill, we turned right. I sighed with relief. The horse agreed with me that we should turn right. Probably because one always traverses the Lingor Road in a clockwise direction for religious reasons. So we turned right and crossed the Drepung City Road to continue along the Lingor Circuit. Along past the Potala, which I thought was not to be compared to our Chakpori for attractiveness, and across the road to India, leaving the Kaling Chu on our left and the Snake Temple on our right. At the entrance to my former home, a little way farther on, servants saw me coming and hastened to swing open the gates. Straight into the courtyard I rode with a swagger and a hope that I would not fall off. A servant held the horse, fortunately, while I slid off. Gravely, the steward and I exchanged our ceremonial scarves. Bless this house and all that be in it, Honorable Medical Lama, sir, said the steward. May the blessing of Buddha, the Pure One, and All-Seeing One, be upon you and keep you healthy, I replied. Honorable sir, the mistress of the house commands me lead you to her. So off we went, as if I could not have found my own way, with me fumbling to wrap up the bag of herbs with that wretched scarf again. Upstairs in my mother's best room, I was never allowed in here when I was merely a son, I thought. My second thought was to wonder if I should turn and run for it. The room was full of women. Before I could, my mother came towards me and bowed. Honorable sir and son, my friends are here to hear of your account of the honor conferred upon you by the Precious One. Honorable Mother, I replied, the rules of my order prevent me from saying what the Precious One told me. The Lama Mingyar Dondup instructed me to bring you this bag of herbs and to present you with his scarf of greeting. Honorable Lama and Son, these ladies have traveled far to hear of the events of the inmost house and of the Precious One within. Does he really read Indian magazines? And is it true that he has a glass which he can look through and see through the walls of a house? Madam, I answered, I am but a poor medical lama who has recently returned from the hills. It is not for such as I to speak of the doings of the head of our order. I have come only as a messenger. A young woman came up to me and said, Don't you remember me? I am Yaso. To be truthful, I hardly could recognize her. She had developed so much and was so ornamental. I had misgivings. 9 women were too much of a problem for me. Men, now, I knew how to deal with them, but women? They looked at me as if I were a juicy morsel, and they, hungry wolves on the plains. There was but one course of action. Retreat. Honorable Mother, I said, I have delivered my message, and now I must return to my duties. I have been ill and have much to do. With that, I bowed to them, turned, and made off as fast as I decently could. The steward had returned to his office, and the groom brought out the horse. "Help me to mount carefully," I said, "for I have recently had an arm and a shoulder broken, and I cannot manage alone." The groom opened the gate. I rode out just as Mother appeared on the balcony and shouted something. The white horse turned left so that we could travel again clockwise around the Lingore Road. Slowly I rode along, slowly, as I did not want to get back too quickly, past Yingpo Linga, past Muro Gompa, and along the complete circuit. Once again home on the Iron Mountain, I went to the Lama Mingyar Dondup. He looked at me. "Why, Love Sang, have all the wandering ghosts chased you around the city? You look shaken." "Shaken," I answered. "Shaken? My mother had a batch of women there, and they all wanted to know about the inmost one and what he said to me. I told them the rules of the order would not allow me to say, and they made off while I was safe, all those women staring at me." My guide shook and shook with laughter. The more I stared at him in amazement, the more he laughed. "The precious one wanted to know if you had settled down, or if you still had thoughts of home." Lamastic life had upset my social values. Women were strange creatures to me, and they still are. But I am home. Oh, no, I do not want to return to the house of my father. The sight of those women painted stuff on their hair, and the way they looked at me, as if I were a prize sheep and they butchers from show. Screeching voices, and their astral colors, dreadful. Oh, Honorable Lama, do not let us discuss it. For days I was not allowed to forget it. "O Love Sang, put to flight by a pack of women," or, "Love Sang, I want you to go to your honorable mother. She has a party today, and they need entertaining." But after a week, I was again told that the Dalai Lama was very, very interested in me, and had arranged for me to be sent home when my mother had one of her numerous social parties. No one ever obstructed the precious one. We all loved him, not merely as a god on earth, but as the true man that he was. His temper was a bit hasty, but so was mine, and he never let personal bias interfere with the duties of the state. Nor did he stay in a temper for more than minutes. He was the supreme head of state and church. End of chapter 13.